Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Sam Woodward was a troubled loner. His high school classmate, Blaise Bernstein, was confident, smart, funny, gay, and Jewish. And while Blaise was making plans for his future, enrolling at UPenn, Sam got sucked into the dark regions of the internet where neo-Nazism and white extremism thrive. For reasons that may never be fully understood, Sam fixes attentions on Blaise. In his article in the current issue of Mother Jones, Boy Meets Hate, How a Gay Teen and an Internet Nazi and a Late-Night Rendezvous Turned to Tragedy, Jonathan Crone investigates Sam's world and explores the tragic outcome of what happens when self-loathing meets the new age of extremism. Jonathan Crone is a freelance writer who's contributed to The Atlantic, Agence France-Presse, The Washington Post, The New York Times, and many other publications. Are very pleased to welcome him to our show now. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What was Sam arrested for?
Sam was arrested for the murder of Blaise Bernstein back in January of 2018, primarily because he was the last one to see Blaise alive, and this was discovered because Sam Blaise's family, after he disappeared, they started looking through his Snapchat history, through the people he'd been contacting, and Sam had been the last person he'd been in contact with. So they were able to get in contact with him. They spoke to him on the phone. They gave his number to the police, and he basically led them directly to where the body of Blaise Bernstein would be found about a week later.
And he did little to cover up the crime, didn't he? Keep the knife.
That's correct. He kept the knife. He kept the knife that was allegedly used in the crime. It had Blaise's blood on it, still stained all the way down the blade, all the way down to the handle. He kept it in his desk drawer, in the second drawer from the top, and he kept it in his room, in his bedroom, and inexplicably.
You write that Sam found plenty of people to help him nurture his hate. First, he joined Vanguard America, a group that marched in Charlottesville. And wasn't Vanguard America the group where a member drove his car into a crowd, killing Heather Heyer?
So he wasn't. Sam was an actual member who killed Heather Heyer. Was somebody who marched with them. He wasn't really a full member, but Sam was a member of the group. Really. Early on, when they used to do what were called like Skype groups, so each state would have their own individual group on Skype where they would communicate with one another, and they would find allies and friends they could engage in Nazi, you know, kind of talking about Nazism and new ideas and what they could do and activism in their own state. So Sam was involved in the group in California, which is how he met a lot of his friends that would later bring him into Adam Wathan.
But didn't that group prove too restrained for his taste? Is that why he transferred to Adam Wathan Division?
Yeah, so what happened was Vanguard America was far more interested in talking about a lot of things. They weren't interested in a lot of direct action. They weren't doing much other than the marches and so on. Really what happened was a friend of Sam's who went by the name Cruz, who was a member who was from Southern California, which is how he was in the Skype group with Sam for the California members of Vanguard America. But he was also a member of the Texas Division. He kind of traveled around. And he had read a book called Siege by a neo-Nazi named James Mason. And Siege really talked a lot about violent revolution and about getting off the grid and kind of creating violent change and revolution on a smaller individual level, and that really appealed to a lot of these young men, and it appealed to a lot of guys who were already a part of Vanguard America, but wanted something more radical, who wanted to actually take violent action. So it appealed to Sam. Cruz sent him the book, and pretty much immediately after he read it, he left Vanguard America and applied to be a member of Adam Woffen.
I should point out that James Mason is not the famous actor.
No, absolutely not. This James Mason's very much alive, whereas the actor is sadly dead.
Now, Cruz spells his name K-R-U-U-Z. Is that his name, his internet name, or is that his real name?
Yeah, that's his internet name. It's unclear. We have photos which have been identified by former members of Adam Woffen. We know who he is, what he looks like, but I really can't confirm what his real name is, simply because he's done a very good job concealing it. But the name that he went by in Adam Woffen was Cruz. The name he went by in Vanguard America was Cruz. That's how everybody referred to him. In the Adam Woffen chat logs, which I've seen from 2017 going into early 2018 when the murder of Blaze happened, everybody referred to him as Cruz. Or Crazy Cruz, or any variation on that theme.
According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, Adam Woffen Division's members are described as accelerationists. What does that mean?
Adam Woffen believes that their main goal is to have the race war, the revolution that'll change America and destroy society as we know it, come quicker. They believe everything that they do is with the goal of bringing about that cataclysm faster. So they believe, for example, they refer to the government, society, culture, the current state of race relations as the system, and they believe that the system needs to be overturned. So it's really about mass destruction. I mean, they're not going around like, you know, blowing up buildings and whatnot. Though some of them have been in trouble for building bombs, they're more so trying to, on a smaller individual level, break away from the system and commit crimes on a smaller level, such as killing one or two people, that foment anger and create conflict within the system, so that they can create a race war, which they believe will destroy society, and then from the ashes of that society, they'll be able to build a fascist empire on top of those ashes.
Those goals have been around for a while. I seem to remember Charles Manson wanted to foment a race war many, many years ago. But the Southern Poverty Law Center says that Adam Woffen is not only interested in violence, but also in depravity and degeneracy as the only sure way to establish order in a dystopian and apocalyptic world that they envision. So depravity and degeneracy?
That's an interesting way to word it. I think a better way to understand Adam Woffen's depravity or degeneracy, if you want to use that term, would be really it's in a lot of ways it's taking things that are uncouth, things that are disgusting, things that are depraved, and taking them to an extreme. It's a lot like trolling or posting on the internet in a lot of cases. And for a lot of the young men that are members of Adam Woffen, that's about as far as it goes. So there's a lot of posting, and there's in their chat logs they'll say very disgusting stuff. They'll say very depraved stuff, and for most of them that's as far as it goes. But for some of them, it's very much a part of their ideology. So they do believe, in the case of particularly those who do commit violent acts, and this is what Mason teaches, that there's no such thing as morality. that morality is a construct of the system used to keep down revolutionaries. And so, really, the only true morality is whatever leads you closer to that goal of a race war, of revolution, and destroying the system. So whatever that entails, whatever that means, whether that be depraved or whether that be disgusting, whatever that is, it's not immoral. It's just whatever gets you closer to that goal. So for those who are, you know, kind of making these posts and saying depraved things and acting in a particular way, there's members of the group who are part of a satanic cult, for example. And they say a lot of very bizarre things that have absolutely nothing to do with Nazism, but I would fall into that category of depraved. For them, at least, it's part of the larger issue of fighting the system by fighting against traditional mores, against traditional morality.
Well, they don't believe in morality in other ways as well. They are misogynistic, many of them. They talk about a few of them about being pedophiles. Even though they're white supremacists, they brag about all of the young African American girls they have slept with. This is all part of the same kind of thing, the things that they talk about on the iFunny platforms?
Adam often decries iFunny, and Sam, who was a big user on iFunny for a while, that's how he met a lot of his early Nazi friends, were he actually said that iFunny was such a waste of time and he wished he hadn't done it. But that's how he got radicalized, was he was kind of making these posts that were rather, before he even heard about Adam Waffen, before he heard about Siege, before he was even in Vanguard America, he would make these posts that were just weird and kind of trolly, and everybody kind of took him as, you know, another edgy internet guy. And but it was on there that he kind of found a community of other young men who were similarly feeling frustrated with the world that they world that they lived in, and they were looking for some kind of community of other young white men who were angry and were frustrated with the world. And that's how he met a group of young Nazis, kind of led sort of by this internet persona of a guy in Ohio, a young kid who went by the name Bill, who I've spoken with, and they kind of coalesced around ideas that white people were being disenfranchised by lower birth rates or whatever, a bunch of, you know, stuff that they really didn't know much about, and they just kind of coalesced around those ideas. And some of them became more radical, like Sam, and they went over to more radical sites like Iron March, where there was recruitment for groups like Vanguard America and Adam Waffen. And then others of them kind of faded away, like Bill, who ended up going to college and getting a girlfriend and having a normal life. But it's right, you're right, that these places like iFunny and a lot of other sites, they allow people to build communities. And whether that's good or bad is up to the community they build.
Where does the name Adam Waffen Division come from?
Well, Adam Waffen is the German term for atomic weapon. So it just literally means atomic weapon division, and their logo is a radioactive symbol. So that's the idea.
My guest is Jonathan Crone, whose article in the current issue of Mother Jones is Boy Meets Hate, How a Gay Teen, an Internet Nazi, and a Late Night Rendezvous Turn to Tragedy. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. According to the group's private chat log, Sam was something of an expert on fascist thought. How did he gain that expertise?
Well, I use the term expert in the piece in the sense of Adam Waffen, because he was an expert as far as they were concerned. He read James Mason's book, and he visited Mason, the Nazi, of course, once again, at his home in Colorado. He pored over Siege, which is a very long book. It's over 500 pages of just Nazi rants. It's basically a compilation of James Mason's newsletter that he wrote in the 80s. But it's he really like spent a lot of time thinking about what James Mason talked about the violence that he talked about what James Mason called dropping out, which is the idea that you leave society, you go off the grid, and you become a full-time Nazi revolutionary. He also started reading a lot of books about the Nazis, about Hitler, and all these other kind of things to supplement that. But he was really that he became an expert on Siege, and he would quiz new potential members. He would give them tests to make sure they knew Siege. At one point, he wanted to create like a formal, like written test for Siege to make sure people really read it. Like he was very dedicated to the ideas that James Mason put forward, so much so that, as I mentioned, he and Cruz and Ryan, who's the Adam Waffen leader in Colorado, the three of them visited James Mason in the summer of 2017 and stayed with him for a couple days at his apartment in Colorado just to kind of, you know, learn at the feet of the master.
So he was vetting new AWD members to make sure that they were committed revolutionaries. How many Adam Waffen members are there in the United States, do we know?
It's hard to say. They've also had a lot of internal disputes, even in the past few months. So it's hard to say how many are left. You could say a few dozen, I at least, to be on the conservative and safe side. But what's more important is that are the people that are influenced by their ideas and by their thoughts. James Mason, until recently, when the site was shut down, but he had a website dedicated to all things Siege. He was putting out new issues of Siege as a newsletter. He was putting out new columns and new essays on Nazi thought in the modern era. He had a podcast. There's an entire Nazi podcasting network that appears to have been shut down since then, called Radio Werewolf. And they had a lot of Nazi podcasts, including James Mason's. So their ideas were getting spread to people outside of their immediate circle of core members. And that's really the danger. Of course, in February, a member of Adam Waffen in Texas was indicted on child porn charges at a court in San Antonio. So, I mean, they're still around, and they're still doing stuff. It's different than it was at the point when Sam was getting involved in 2017 and when the murder of Blaise Bernstein happened in early 2018. Things have changed a lot since then.
There was a thing called siege pilling. What was that?
Well, siege pill, the term siege pill is just like, so on the internet, when people talk about, you know, different types of radicalization and different types of thought, there's a red pill, black pill, all these different concepts. So it basically means that you've kind of taken the medicine, or in a more old world sense, like you drank the Kool-Aid. It means that you believe in the ideas that you're being fed. You know that you're taking the information of Siege, you're taking the ideas of James Mason, and you fully believe it. You're fully committed to it. So it means that you're being given, and so to siege pill somebody as a verb would be to give them siege, to teach them about the ideas of James Mason, and to be siege pilled means that you take that information and you fully believe it.
Didn't Ohio ban James Mason from entering the state without permission from a court?
Yeah. So in after a his second child porn conviction, he was in 1993. James Mason was technically, I mean, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, so I'm not sure whether this would actually hold up on appeal, but or legally, But the court said that he was banned. He shall not return to the state of Ohio without prior written consent of the court. That was because he had he made a plea bargain. He had the same set of child porn photos that he'd been busted for a few years before, back in the late 80s. And they kind of just wanted to be rid of him. So he moved, and he was also kind of planning to leave anyway. So he sold off all his property and moved to Colorado, which is where he is now. Moved to a small town in southern Colorado, really in the Great Plains, where he was three years later, he was indicted on child porn charges again. And he spent some time in jail, and then he ended up leaving there and moved to Denver, where he lives now.
Does it seem to bother any of the people in Adam Waffen or the related groups that he was into child porn? Or does with the genius of James Mason?
No, they're totally fine with it. In fact, in the chats, they get kind of excited that he had. He also had sex with a number of underage girls, including one young girl he raped who was 9 years old. But they were well aware that he had a proclivity for young girls and that he had raped and molested and taken photos of underage girls. In fact, they thought it made him more badass that he was this old man having sex with underage girls. In their Discord chat, they had a bot, which whenever you I don't remember what the word was, but if you typed in a keyword, this bot in the Discord chat would feed you back a particular James Mason quote. And one of the quotes that they had to do quite a lot was from a very disgusting Nazi art book called Art That Kills, where James Mason was quoted as saying that was quoted as bragging about underage girls, saying I believe the wording was, and I'm trying to do this off the top of my head, was anybody who says they don't have a thing for young girls is either a queer or a liar. And he talked about getting in trouble for his child porn and how women were jealous that he wasn't doing it to them and the men were jealous that they weren't doing it. So they were proud of him for doing this. They were proud of it. They were aware of it. They were fine with it. It just kind of moved on.
And he wasn't alone. Wasn't there a fellow traveler, if we can use that phrase, in England who said that that girls are ruined once they pass a certain age, once they become legal?
I mean, that's pretty common. That was pretty common dialogue. That was just one example I used in the piece, but that's correct. Like, there were members of the now more or less defunct Sonnen Krieg Division, which was very short-lived in the UK, which was Adam Waffen's UK affiliate. They had some members who were openly in favor of pedophilia. But the leader of Adam Waffen at the time was a guy in America was a guy named John Cameron Denton, who also was very publicly in favor of James Mason having sex with underage girls. You know, he kept saying teens are the best, for example, was one thing he posted in their chats. And he talked about how the best Siege memes are the ones saying James Mason is a pedophile. Speaking of, since you mentioned the actor James Mason, there was at one point the members of Adam Waffen thought it was so funny that they both had the same name that they took posters from old James Mason films like Age of Consent and Lolita and made them, you know, kind of jokes about James Mason being a pedophile. So they were well aware of it. They thought it was funny at the most and cool at the worst.
The other reason I focus on it a bit is because sex plays such an important role in all of the story, and we'll get to more of that in just a moment. But you write that Adam Waffen, quote, made its debut in 2015, a year that saw white nationalist thinking lifted from the fringe to mainstream debate. A lot of people believe that white nationalist thinking became more mainstream as a direct result of Donald Trump's election, but that wasn't until 2016. What conditions or events led white nationalist thinking going mainstream even earlier? Or is 2015 a fairly late year in all of this story?
Well, I think that there's a lot of factors that contribute to it. I would say, at least in the case of Sam Woodward, he was going to be attracted to, whether it be white nationalism or something else, he was going to be attracted to something radical just simply because of what he was looking for and what he couldn't find. At least that's my opinion based on the reporting I did.
And the internet allows for that. You say the Nazis weren't hiding. They were waiting for guys like Sam with open arms.
Absolutely, absolutely. And look, the internet is an easy recruiting ground for groups like Adam Wofford. It's an easy place for radical groups to find disenfranchised or at least upset and angry and frustrated racist, or at least open to being racist, young white men, just like it is for any other group, for that matter. You know, why? Just the same way that it was easy for a group like ISIS to recruit angry young men to come join them from around the world. I don't think it's necessarily one thing. So there's also the fact that, of course, as many people have noted in the past, that white nationalism saw an uptick during the Obama era. Having a black president was good recruiting fodder for white nationalist groups. That's certainly part of it as well. The rise of Donald Trump and him echoing white nationalist dog whistles on a national level was certainly helpful for white nationalist groups. I mean, there are many factors, but I think that the biggest one is the one that there's really hardly anything that can be done about, which is that online communities, whether they be iFunny, whether it be Facebook, whether it be Twitter, whatever it might be, allow for like-minded people to find each other. And when people are angry, and when people are frustrated, and when people are in despair and feel like they've lost hope in society, they're easily swept up in a radical agenda, whatever that might be.
Ironically, James Mason didn't own a computer. But
that's correct. Yeah, he does all of his work still. I mean, he's still alive. I mean, he lives in downtown Denver.
And you've even met with him. We'll talk about that in a little while.
Yeah. He still writes on a typewriter. He always has. He doesn't understand computers, as he likes to say. Until they shut down the site, he would write. What he would do is he would write down his columns and he would mail them to an Adam Wofford member, who would then upload them on the internet. And then for his podcast, he would have a phone call with somebody and read out a speech that he'd written down, and they would record it over the phone, and then they'd upload that to the internet. So, he's very much a Luddite in that sense. He does not care for technology. He has no understanding of technology. But I think as he started getting around some of these younger guys, and you would see this in his more recent writing and talking to him, he started to realize the benefits of this technology. He was not aware of the recruitment, for the record. Like, he was not aware that people were using his book and building an entire group around his book, because they didn't meet with him. Adam Wofford didn't find him until the spring of 2017, which was, you know, a year and a half, really, after they had founded themselves in 2015. So he was not aware that Siege was being used and had a whole resurgence until members of Adam Wofford came to his house in Colorado in early 2017. So he wasn't aware of that, but I think he is very much grateful, from having talked to him, that they're bringing his ideas into the 21st century and that he has new relevance. He needs their energy and their support of him just as much as they need his ideas. He really has nothing else going on in his life. And being the Nazi guru is kind of gives him purpose, I think.
Jonathan Crone is my guest on Leonard Lopate at Large today. His article in the current issue of Mother Jones, Boy Meets Hate, How a Gay Teen, an Internet Nazi, and a Late Night Rendezvous Turned to Tragedy. You write that you were attracted to this story because there was something gut-wrenchingly intimate about this murder. What was it?
I mean, I couldn't put my finger on it at first, but it was something. The thing is, when we think about terrorism or when we think about ideological killings, when we think about violence based on political ideology, we assume that it's big. You know, we associate with big things, especially with terrorism. We associate it with, you know, tragedies like 9/11 or even mass shootings. We associate with the killing of you know, 5 or 10 or 20 or 30, whatever. We associate it with bigger numbers. This was a one-on-one interaction between two young men who knew each other from high school, or at least knew of each other. They were never friends, really. But two young men who knew each other in a very late at night, alone, in a car, in a suburban parking lot, and then in a suburban park. Like it was not a riot where somebody, you know, somebody gets caught in the fray or killed. It was very intimate. It was very direct. This was a moment where, Sam allegedly, because he has not been convicted, but Sam allegedly would have had to look at the person he was killing and know him. Like it was a selection. He knew this person. This was somebody he was familiar with. So,
and arrange for a hookup.
Right. Well, it's unclear. It's unclear to me whether that was the case or not. I mean, that's the ultimate question that only Sam Woodward can answer now. But they had met on Tinder, and I found that out because I have copies of some of their Tinder messages, and I've seen Sam's Tinder profile, and I met with people, at least one other person who they both knew from high school, who Sam had also matched with Tinder that same day. But Sam and Blaze had matched on Tinder, that's right, back in May of 2017, just a few months before Sam actually went to go meet Mason in Colorado. And Sam, you know, he had this persona where he would talk about, like, when he would flirt with guys. At least when he flirted with Blaze, he started out not like saying that he was interested in guys, that he was looking, quote unquote, for a hunting buddy, and that he had sex with a lot of black women, that he had, quote unquote, jungle fever was the wording he used. And he would put on this kind of macho air, and In the logs that I have between Sam and Blaze was sending these to a friend of his while this was happening, because it was so bizarre to him, because Sam had always been kind of this weird kid in high school who never really fit in, who was certainly not openly gay. And he
although there were rumors.
There were certainly rumors. There were rumors about Sam being gay in high school, that he had similarly flirted with a young man who was openly gay at their high school, who was very openly gay. and the story goes, at least according to that young man, which is what he told me and then he later told the police, was that he had first started asking questions about his identity. And this was back when they were in middle school, when they were in like 7th, 8th grade. And he was messaging this young gay kid, asking him about how he came out, how he knew he was gay. And then as time went on, he started sending, you know, selfies, sending sexually charged messages. This is probably when they were really freshmen, sophomores in high school at this point. And he started asking him out on a date, and the guy rejected him. And it just made the young man that that Sam was messaging very uncomfortable. And so he showed the message to Blaze and another friend or two, and the rumor kind of ended up spreading around. But nobody knew for sure. Those messages are long since gone. I asked the young man who told me this story and who told the police this and who told Blaze this if he had access to the photos anymore or to the videos and the messages, and he said no, he didn't have them. but Blaze was certainly aware of this, and the first thing that he said when he saw Sam on Tinder was, OMG, this guy in high school, who I'm not going to mention his name for his privacy, but we'll call him Jared, that's what I call him in the piece. Mm-hmm. OMG, Jared was telling the truth for once, and then an expletive. So he was aware of this rumor about Sam, and I think that's part of what made Sam, if he was lying, if this was nonsense, that's what made it easy for Sam to convince people that he was a closeted gay man or bisexual. But it also makes it difficult from a journalistic perspective to say that he was trying to trick Blaze, because he has this history of going back to middle school, which he claimed in his diaries was all fake. He wrote in his personal diary, which the police found on his phone, that this was all a ploy, going back to middle school, going back to Jared, who he mentions by name. It was all a ploy to get gay kids, to hurt gay kids, whether it be physically or mentally by, as he put it, cucking them over and over. It's hard to say what was going through Sam's head when he met with Blaze, because he's had so many contradictory versions of his own story, the versions that other people see and the version that he sees of himself.
You write that you are bisexual and Jewish. Did you identify with Blaze at all when you were working on the story?
I did, to an extent. You know, I identified with the... I identified, and at least this is what I thought I would identify the most with. I identified with the with him as a young man, as a writer, and as a young LGBT Jewish man. This happened with somebody that he knew, somebody he went to high school with, somebody that he'd met on Tinder. This could really happen to almost anybody. It was kind of what my initial reaction was to it, and that was also part of what I say was so gut-wrenching about it and intimate, that it was so one-on-one, and it's one of those interactions that in this current era of online dating is so common. It's scary. It's very scary. But as I got more into it, it was far more complex than that. It was something that was very specific to Sam, and of course there are lots of young men like him. But Sam's story is something that could have. There are so many moments along the way where it could have been stopped, you know, and where he could have gone down a different path, where somebody could have seen something, but he somehow was able to keep getting deeper and deeper and deeper into Nazism. He was able to push himself further down that hole, you know. And instead of dealing with his identity issues that he very clearly had, the way that Blaze did, and Blaze had his own struggles with his identity, as I discussed in the piece. He was never really comfortable talking about his sexuality until really he started getting into high school, into college, and that's when he started exploring it more, as his friends told me. And he never really talked about it with his family, but he dealt with it in his own way. And Sam did the same thing. He dealt with his life and his identities and his sexuality in his own way. He felt he needed to be more macho, and he had this persona going back to high school where he was, you know, very militant and angry and frustrated and mean. He was never open with people. He never wanted to have. He never tried to make friends. Nobody really remembers him hanging out with anybody. He was so closed up. I think that was a major reason that he found this community online that would accept him.
Sam and his chat pals complained about sexual frustration in their online chats. Is there any overlap between white nationalists and the so-called incels, the involuntary celibates? Because in the end, they were desperate for two things, acceptance and sex.
Right. And I think that... I think that there's certainly some overlap in rhetoric, and I think that's more so due to the fact that both of these are communities born of the internet. The incels find their community on, you know, forums, on whether it be on Reddit or elsewhere, and so the rhetoric is the same because it comes from the internet. So there is a lot of overlap in that sense. I wouldn't say that, as far as I know, any Adam Woffen members or members of iFunny were actual formal incels who were going onto incel forums. I don't know that, and I don't think that's the case. But certainly Bill, who was the kind of the leader of the iFunny fascists and Nazis that Sam fell in with early in his radicalization when he was still a senior in high school, these guys used a lot of the very same language about not being able to get laid, not women not wanting them, and how they needed to take charge, and all these kinds of things. So I would say there is some overlap, but I think it's more due to the nature of these communities, and I think that is certainly part of the problem. That there is an entire subculture that I think to people who are outside of these subcultures who don't understand them have a very different lexicon. They have a very different lingua franca than other groups, and that's because that's their culture. That's their community. Those are the people that they're around, and those words make sense to them. The usage of the word cuck, for example, that became far more common in the mainstream political discussion a few years back, but it's something that comes from the internet, and it's something that comes from these internet discussions and forums.
What about you? You published some years ago an article with the heading, "I was a right-wing child star," and you say that at the age of 13, you gave a speech at the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC.
That's right.
Have you come a long way, or were you always, or was that just a strange aberration?
I was very interested in conservative talk radio. I grew up in Atlanta, where our local talk station was the biggest station, bigger than the music stations for a very long time. I believe it still is. I grew up listening to talk radio, and that's kind of how I got into conservative politics, because I thought that I enjoyed the performance, I guess, and I enjoyed listening to these guys rant and rave for 3 hours a day, and it was just entertaining, and I believed a lot of this stuff because I grew up around it. My parents were conservative. They weren't, Nazis or anything like that, but they were pretty mainstream conservatives. And so I grew up around that, and I wrote a book called Defining Conservatism that I self-published, and I called the Conservative Political Action Conference and asked if I could speak there, and they gave me a two-minute spot on a panel, and I spoke about pretty mainstream, banal ideas of conservatism, life and liberty and stuff like that. So it really was never for me on a radical level. I mean, Even when I spoke at like tea parties and stuff, I would listen to certain people, and I would say they were pretty extreme, the way that they were talking about the president and things like that. So by the time I was 17, I kind of got out of that. I kind of stopped doing it when I was about 14, 15, but I got out of doing it. I formally wrote that essay that you're talking about being a right-wing child star. I wrote that when I was 17, and that's when I kind of formally addressed it. I was never a radical, and I was never part of those online communities that you're talking about.
You didn't run into any alt-right people at the time.
No, I mean, let's be honest. The alt-right, the way that we see it now, was never really, CPAC was never their, it was never their bailiwick, That's not a place they're going to hang out. That's the domain of people like Newt Gingrich and people that they consider cucks. Like, they don't consider these people to be extreme enough. The alt-right types I never really saw them at CPAC in, 2009. Like, that's not where they're going to hang out. I was never a part of that, and I think it's important for people to understand the distinction here. I think that we throw around terms regarding fascism and Nazism with great abandon, and there are real horrible Nazis out there who are violent. There are people, the leader of Atomwaffen is currently in federal prison because he was building bombs in his garage. There are people who are deadly, and they have killed, and they will kill again, and they've been doing this for a very long time. Violent Nazis exist. They're not the same as your mainstream conservative. Certainly, there is overlap on the right because they're both right-wing ideologies, so you're going to find certain dog whistles that are used by everybody. But I think it's important that we understand where the line is drawn, because if we use these terms with abandon, we kind of lose track of who is a Nazi and who is just a right-wing zealot of some other stripe. So I think that the the Nazis are important to keep in their own category. And Adam Waffen are certainly Nazis, and they're very proud of that. Vanguard America is certainly a fascist organization, and they're very proud of that. Identity Europa, groups like this are certainly fascists and Nazis, and there's a lot of them, and they're growing, and their influence is growing. That's certainly true.
Now, Sam's friend Bill, who you mentioned earlier, went to a Christian college, and religion replaced fascism. Wasn't Sam's family very religious? Didn't they go to church every day?
Yeah, that's correct.
What was their response to all of this, to discovering this?
Well, they wouldn't talk to me. I reached out to them many times. They won't talk to the press. Interestingly enough, the knife that Sam stabbed Blaze, or allegedly stabbed Blaze with, the knife that had Blaze's blood on it, let's put it that way, had Sam's father's name engraved on the blade, Blake Woodward. But his father, I don't think, was aware of this. I don't know if his father was. Sam writes in the Adam Waffen chats that he believed his father was ripe for Nazism. He talked about watching World War II films and how his dad was upset over the dead Germans. Unclear if that's true or not, but that's what Sam claimed. Sam believed his parents would one day be open to fascism. He as I say in the piece, he came out to them openly as a Nazi. And told his friends this, because he left and he went on the road with Cruz for several months in Texas. So his parents were certainly aware of his proclivities, at least according to Sam. I do not know what their reaction was, because they did not tell me. But his parents were certainly very religious. Sam was raised in the Catholic Church. His father was a scoutmaster, and both Sam and his brother were Eagle Scouts. They were raised in that kind of suburban Catholic scouting tradition of manhood, and that much we know. I can't tell you further what his parents say.
Now, you didn't meet with them, but you have met with some of the people that you've written about in this story. How did you contact them, and how open were they?
Well, I spoke with, I think the first person I contacted was Blaze's family. Well, I also contacted at the same time Sam's family, but Blaze's family were the first ones to talk to me and agree to meet with me. And it was through them that I met Blaze's ex-boyfriend, who kind of helped put me in contact with some of Blaze's friends who his mother would not put me in contact with, but who very much wanted to talk, and they hadn't talked to people before, and that would be Lily Williams and so on. These were Blaze's best friends. These were his closest friends. These were the people he told about Sam when he first found him on Tinder. So I started just contacting people that way, and then one person would lead to another, and I stayed out there for a few weeks, and then I came back a few months later to do some follow-ups. So I just kind of, it was really about digging and going through everybody I could find that they knew. You know, sometimes it meant going through social media pages and finding people who were Facebook friends with them, or finding somebody who, was a Twitter follower of them who was this person they mentioned, because they might not have their number anymore. You know, it was about digging and just basic journalistic shoe leather reporting, going from person to person to person to find the right individuals for the story.
And what about Brandon Russell, an Adam Waffen leader whom Cruz discovered via Twitter? His roommate, Devon Arthurs, is one of the advocates for a thing called lone wolfing that Adam Waffen suggested, lone wolfing by small cells. He converted to Islam, and isn't he in prison now?
Well, Devon Arthurs is not in prison. He's in he's in a mental hospital in Florida. He's in the state hospital there because he was deemed mentally incapable of standing trial. Devon Arthurs shot two of his and Brandon Russell's roommates, who were also Adam Waffen members, claiming that they had made fun of his conversion to Islam. And then he went across the street to a smoke shop and held some people hostage and shouted some vague stuff about, you know, U.S. imperialism and war in the Middle East and nonsense. But he was deemed to be mentally incapable to stand trial, and he's currently in a mental hospital in Florida. Brandon Russell, who was the founder of Adam Waffen, Cruz found him. That's how he found Siege, was through Brandon, because Brandon ran the Adam Waffen Twitter account, which is long since suspended. But they would tweet out links to the PDF copy of Siege, and that's how Cruz found it. And Brandon ran that Twitter account. Brandon was a National Guardsman in Florida, kind of a stocky, basically exactly what you think a National Guardsman would look like. A stocky, well-built guy who was more so interested than the later leaders of Adam Waffen, but he was very much interested in the militant possibilities of his group. And he was building bombs in his garage, as I mentioned earlier, and storing them, for some reason, in a cooler that he kept secured with packing tape. So he was building bombs, unclear exactly what the stated purpose was. The FBI, I found some potential plans. It's unclear whether that's really what he was targeting, so I'm not going to mention it. But he was making bombs, and these were highly controlled explosives, and he had quite a bit of it already to carry out some kind of attack, allegedly, and that's what he was charged with.
Now,
so he's currently in a federal prison.
Adam Waffen members hate Jews and non-whites. Are they generally okay with Muslims? As Devon Arthurs?
No, and they were very upset with Devon Arthurs. Devon Arthurs had converted to Islam long before this incident, and originally there was a plan for Brandon and the Adam Waffenites from Florida. They were going to go on a road trip to all the cells across the country. And the members of the Texas cell, which included Cruz and Sam at the time, I guess Sam wasn't a member at the time. This was a few months before he joined. But Cruz and a few of the other Texas members said that if Devon came to Texas, they would not talk to him, they would not interact with him, and they did not want him to interact with them at all. They didn't want him there because he had converted to Islam, and they did not respect him.
Now you've written a lot about that world. You covered the genocide of Yazidis by ISIS in Iraq, the political rise of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in Egypt, the Kurdish independence movement in southern Turkey. So this has been a real interest to you, but haven't you now decided to do a series on neo-Nazism in America?
That's kind of the plan here. This is kind of the first in a series of planned pieces regarding these violent groups, Adam Waffen being one of them, but there's other groups as well, and kind of the getting into the individual stories, not kind of focusing on this kind of big interpretation of what the right's doing in America, but individuals and how they are influencing others and how they are what they are doing in events like this where people's lives are changed, where people die because and in the case of Sam, at least, where his life is ruined and he's in jail and he could very well spend the rest of his life in prison over an ideology that he found on the internet. So
or perhaps over sexual confusion.
Potentially, and that's these are all questions that I think are important, and these are stories that I think need to be told because they're often told in a way that ignores the granular issues that are so much a part of this, that should be at least so much a part of this discussion over why people are radicalized and why people do these things and why people are attracted to radical ideologies and how we can address them in the future. Because if we don't understand who is committing these acts and why they're committing these acts and who is inspiring them to commit these acts and who is inspiring them to be radicalized and what the effects of that are, then we don't really understand it at all. It kind of becomes a monster that's just crawling out of the cave, we just kind of, take aim at it willy-nilly and don't really understand what it is. So we kind of need to understand it better, and that's kind of part of what I'm trying to do with this work.
And in reading the article, I was surprised that James Mason agreed to speak with you. Did he know that you were writing an article for Mother Jones?
Yes, he called me. I had reached out to somebody who knew him in his hometown in Ohio, and they had my phone number, and they gave it to Mason, and he called me, left a voicemail on my cell phone, and told me that he thought we should chat.
Any publicity is good publicity? Is that the point?
I suppose. I mean, he doesn't seem to care. He knows people don't like him. He knows that he knows what people are going to say about him regardless, you know, and it's uncanny, and it feels kind of gross in the sense that he initiated it, and so it makes me feel kind of out of place, and I think that's very much what he wants when he makes these calls to people and when he talks to journalists, is that he wants to kind of get the upper hand. So it did feel kind of uncomfortable, and he was very open about it, and he was very proud of it, you know, telling me that having sex with young girls was, they might not be legal under man's law, but they're under the law of nature and God, they're legal, and stuff like that. Like, he had a defense for everything. He was very quick to say that he was not a pedophile because, again, they're legal under God's law, which is such an absurd thing to say. And he knows this. He knows that these are absurd things to say, and he does not care. So James Mason was very open about talking about it. He was open about talking about meeting Sam. He was open about talking about Siege and about how it's influenced young men. He gave me his address and told me to come meet him in person, which I have not done yet, but I plan to do at some point. And we spoke at great length about this stuff, and he was very open about it.
And it's been great talking with you. Unfortunately, I've run out of time.
No problem.
Jonathan Crone's article in the current issue of Mother Jones is Boy Meets Hate, How a Gay Teen, an Internet Nazi, and a Late Night Rendezvous Turned to Tragedy. Thank you so much for being on our show. And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Susie Stoltz, who produced this segment. Wanted Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.